Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
So what were some of the most valuable lessons you've learned from your mentors? Is there anything you could share with us that really stood out?
Yeah, I think it's probably repeating myself, but I think it's really just, focus on one thing, do it well, and, quality above all else. And I think I learned that from my father and grandfather in the vineyards from a very young age. And I think that's really served me well, and just a good examples for work ethic, which I think
old-fashioned values.
I think it could be never underrated. So I think if you have that type of focus combined with knowledge and a work ethic, that's a pretty good combination.
So you decided to make your own label at one point.
I mean, it was always germinating. It didn't hit me right away, but it was just kind of the ability of, how do I really do it? Mm-hmm. And, Custom Crush hasn't always been around, and, I didn't see any really good facilities. So when I did find one, I thought it was, a good way to kind of start out and start, trying to experiment with the wine to get it where I needed it to be. And so that was probably around, 2007. Mm-hmm. Is when the thought process started to develop. And I think with the wines that I was trialing and testing, I was getting to a point where I could see it in a couple of years.
Wow. So did you have a portfolio in mind? Did you know you wanted to make reds or whites, or was there any specific things?
It was Cabernet.
And you wanted Cabernet.
It was Cabernet. Okay. Yeah, that's... Okay, I always say I'm passionate about Cabernet, but excited about Sauvignon Blanc. Just because we had a, Cabernet is, expresses really well from Rutherford, and that's what we planted. And I added Sauvignon Blanc to the program in 2014. I just think it's an exciting varietal. It's versatile. There's a lot of ways you can go with it. A lot of different clones that express different characteristics. And I wanted to keep it alive because, speaking of Cabernets, everybody's pulling out other vineyards and planting Cabernet. So
yeah.
I never want Rutherford to be a mono culture in terms of variety. So it's nice to see Sauvignon Blanc coming, being showcased a little bit more and highlighted and profiled. So,
speaking of, I just took a sip of 2017 Sauvignon Blanc, which is so delicious.
Thank you.
And you said the bottle that we're sampling has been open overnight, which is another really powerful statement. Typically, Sauvignon Blanc is perceived as something that's drunk right then and there.
Right.
And this is a testament right there that it actually developed so much more.
Yeah. Yeah. So this has been in the bottle probably a little over a year now, and it's in a dark bottle, which is non-traditional for Sauvignon Blanc. And I call this a reserve. It's 85% Sauvignon Blanc from Oakville and 15% organic Semillon from Rutherford.
Oh.
And we age it all in new but untoasted French oak, so it's meant to keep the purity of the fruit but impart those textures that you get from oak. So just a little less tannins, light toast level, so you get somebody who's familiar with Chardonnay who likes that mouthfeel from oak and maybe a little butteriness. They get the mouthfeel, but they have the acidity and the varietal characteristics from Sauvignon Blanc.
It is very elegant.
Thank
you. Very elevated, and just such a pleasure to smell and taste. And, it has this really brilliant acidity and minerality that makes it hard to, in my mind, I wouldn't be able to determine where it's from. It doesn't have this one character, this is New Zealand or this is France or whatever. It has this really beautiful fusion of different flavors and sensations that makes this a very, powerful example of what Sauvignon Blanc can be.
Right.
So I can see why you're excited about it, and I'm so glad that you started that program.
Yeah, yeah. And so I have another Napa Valley Sauvignon Blanc, which is all Sauvignon Blanc, and aged 20, you know, 80% stainless steel, but 20% untoasted French oak with acacia heads.
Acacia heads, is that kind of a unique element? Or?
Yeah, I mean, we worked with a cooper to create this barrel with a French oak staves and then acacia heads, and acacia grows in the same forest as French oak, just tighter grained, less tannins. So they call it the fresh barrel, however you say fresh in French. And yeah, now it's just a way to keep it fresh, and it's a way to give it a little bit more texture and have it drink like Sauvignon Blanc. So that Sauvignon Blanc's a little bit lighter, a little bit crisper. This one's a little bit more full-bodied. And the Sémillon definitely helps with the richness as well.
Well, it sounds true to form that a lot of thought went into this program. You didn't just decide to make Sauvignon Blanc. You know, I'm hearing a lot of intent, and, you know, conversely, it's certainly expense when you're trying to create something that's true to your vision.
Yeah.
It's not a simple proposition.
No, and I wish I liked American oak more than I liked French, but I think the French oak gives it the right characteristics, and yeah.
So as much as I hate to leave the Sauvignon Blanc territory, because that's so near and dear to my heart, I want to go back to the Cabernet for a second.
Sure.
I'm particularly curious about your years in Europe, because I know you must have been drinking a lot of wine when you were in Rome and Barcelona.
Oh, yeah.
And clearly traveled throughout Italy and Spain. I mean, I can't imagine that you wouldn't. And there must have been some kind of eye-opening experiences with respect to wine and viticulture in Europe. So I just kind of want to flesh it out a little bit to see what might have influenced you.
Just the culture, I mean, is great. I mean, I think from my Italian background, my family's Italian background, you know, wine's always been on the table, and it's just been always been a part of food and wine. So I kind of grew up with those smells of, you know, crush and pumice and all these familiar smells with that's associated with wineries and winemaking.
Yeah.
But it was certainly nice to visit Europe, and, you know, it's nice to be able to order a craft of wine for a couple euros and have the quality be really nice. So that's always great. I think that on average the quality in Europe is better for the price. I don't know if I should say that, but, you know, just because they make on average really good wine for a really good price point. But I really enjoyed the areas of outside of Barcelona, Penedès. You know, some really good fruit there. It's most famous known for Torres, which is the largest producer in Spain, with vineyards in Sonoma, I think, in Chile, and probably a lot of other places I don't know. But there's a lot of smaller vineyards there, and Priorat, a lot of Syrah, Grenache, just a very unique terroir, you know, back to the Roman times, and actually went in aquifers from the Roman times, and just very, very tough country and very stressed vines that produce really great, you know, Syrah, Grenache. And a lot of other varieties. So I was really impressed by those areas. I think in the Baleares Islands, like where Ibiza is, and there's one called Formentera, which the locals go to. I think you got to get there by boat from Ibiza. Really some nice Cabernet comes from there, and I don't think they have enough production to import it here, but I think it's just the art of discovery, and for me at least, the vineyards have probably been there for so long. But it was nice to discover those wines and different varieties and different terroirs, for sure.
Has it influenced your winemaking, you know, not just specific to Cabernet, but in general, like what you've observed, what you've tasted during those years?
Yeah, I mean, I think always just always being curious and always trying to learn, I don't know if you call it new techniques, but or new facts and new, you know, the way that the vineyards are managed, or the way that the winemaking occurs. I mean, there's a lot of things that I didn't really care for, like you know, the regional controls. They tell you how much you can't produce over a certain amount, have to do this and that. I don't like that control because I think it limits expression. I get why they do it in terms of, you know, keeping the quality, just like in Parma, the cheese, there's certain regulations that has to be made from these types of cows with this much milk and age for this long. So I always get that. And they, you know, to be reserve or grand reserve, it has to be X number of months in oak barrels. And I think after a certain number of months, the wine starts to oxidize. So I really like to bottle after 18 months in oak. So I kind of learned what those are some of the things that I was less favorable towards. But I really, you know, respect the way they make their wines and you know, the unique expression. Mm-hmm. There's more of a classification there and, you know, a little bit more history. So I really like what I really like was the heritage and the history. I think what I also did like was just the, in a lot of areas you couldn't water, right? The control, they didn't water. So I think it arguably produces a better grape and a better wine I don't do dry farming, but I do deficit irrigation. Because when you get heat spikes, you gotta give them a little water, or else they're just going to get that heat stroke and start to go dormant. But I really like that type of stress. Hmm. So that's something I really kind of, you know, looked into. And I know there's a few folks around here who do mm-hmm. deficit irrigation or dry farming, like Frog's Leap and Kathy Corson. So I really like that. And I really respect that. And I think it provides a good expression of the vineyards. I think I don't do the dry farming. Like I said, I just do that deficit irrigation, which I think is very good for our vineyards.
Well, water deficit is definitely a hot subject in California. Uh-huh. So maybe born out of necessity, more people start paying attention to it. But it's certainly a very common sentiment that I hear mm-hmm. over and over again. That's stressed, you know. You don't want to dehydrate them completely, but
yeah.
giving them just enough stress certainly produces more concentrated fruit. So when you decided to make Cabernet, which makes all the sense in the world, if you guys have tried Rutherford Cabernets to any extent, it makes a compelling case for that varietal.
Yeah.
Did you have a style in mind, or did it kind of evolve?
I mean, I think it evolved, and I know I'm going to repeat myself, but I always want it to be expression of the vineyard, so I don't want to manipulate it. So styles and decisions that go up into harvest time. So I definitely didn't want it, you know, overly extracted. I didn't want it under extracted. You know, I wanted to harvest at the right time, and usually I go back to the fruit, and so I always taste. I definitely taste the seeds, and they should be brown. And if you eat the seeds or you crunch the seeds, they should mm-hmm. taste like almonds versus something green.
Important.
And so, yeah, it's just, that's kind of like the genesis of the start of the harvest. And then I have what I call a grown-up, take it to the lab and test it to validate, you know, where we want it to be. But, you know, I would say a lot of great winemakers, you know, they do it on, I'm not a great winemaker, I'm not saying that. But I would say a lot of great winemakers, they don't take it to the lab, but they do it off of taste.
You know, to my ears, you can never say it enough.
Yeah.
Because there's true meaning. I know it's said a lot, but there's a true meaning as wine is grown in the vineyard. Mm-hmm. And any great winemaker has to be the vineyardist first. And you're certainly a poster child for that. And it was never a choice. It just implied consent.
Yeah.
You're always part of that completely symbiotic relationship that you have
exactly.
with the land.
Yeah.
And that's so important. You can never state this enough, that know your winemaker, know your maker, mm-hmm. Because if their mind and heart is rooted in the vineyard, you're going to get a good product. The rest of it is just a matter of taste.
Right.
But you're going to get that solid foundational, mm-hmm. The kind of wine that really kind of moves you. You know, it's not just a beverage, but it's truly what I call a conversation waiting to happen. And that's where it starts. It starts with that attachment. You make your own wine?
Yep. I work with a consulting winemaker. So I'm wearing a lot of hats right now. So I want to make sure that everything's executed correctly. So, yeah, I work with a small team now and different functions. But probably up until 6 months ago, I was probably doing most of everything, it seems like. But now, and overall, I have a great team, and it takes a great team to make the wine. So, yeah.
How many wines do you craft?
I do four, three of which are public. My Napa Valley Sauvignon Blanc, my Reserve Sauvignon Blanc, my Rutherford Cabernet, and then I'll be releasing a Red Bordeaux blend. And so the first release, it's 2016, so I'm probably going to officially release it in the fall.
Okay.
And it's a blend of Rutherford Cabernet, Oakville Bench, Cab Franc, and then Hillside Malbec from Stag's Leap.
That's quite a combo. How did that come about?
Yeah, testing, and every vintage is different with my wine, so every vintage speaks for itself. If you taste two different wines from different vintage, you'll know that they're, hopefully know that they're related, but they're not, you know, formulated, you know, the similar. So I just source the five red Bordeaux varietals. I look at the vintage, taste each wine separately, and just start the blending process. So pretty much every, you know, the idea is that every vintage will be different in terms of the blends.
Yeah.
And so it was just the finding the great sources of fruit and working with them. The Hillside Malbec is, you know, smaller berry size. You know, it has that stress level that we want. The Cabernet Cab Franc from Oakville is, you know, Cab Franc on its own is, you really have to work, have an established really good vineyard. And so we found some really good Cab Franc. And then, yeah, the Rutherford Bench Cabernet. So,
seemingly, well, they are so different, but how do you actually fuse this together? I think that in general, blending is such an enigmatic subject matter, even for those of us in the trade, let alone the consumer. How do you know when that perfect confluence occurs?
Yeah, it drives me crazy. I mean, I think the first few blends you can get, you can start blending where you know you're going in the right direction. Mm-hmm. For me, the hardest is what I call the last mile, the last few blends, the last 5-10%. And I literally have to walk away because my palate gets really fatigued. I got to take it home. I got to try it when, you know, after I wake up in the morning before coffee, try it before lunch, and then go back and do it again. So literally I have to step away. I can't taste too long. There's so many winemakers that do it so well and can taste all day until their tongue and their teeth are what I call the Cabernet color and they're numb, but they can do this for that long a time. I can't do it. So it's more of an iterative process, and it's really the last, you know, 10% that's the hardest.
Something tells me that you're a bit of a perfectionist, so it's got to be extremely painful to get it to where you feel this is exactly what I intend to produce.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, I don't know if you call it aha moment or whatever, the vintage founders moment or whatever, but it's that moment where you know you have it. That's the best, right? But it's just, it can drive you crazy sometimes. And I hate going back between the two because then I just, for me, it's when I first taste it, that's when I get it.
Yeah.
And then the second when I go back to it, it gets a little convoluted. So yeah. I really need to take my time, and this is over, you know, weeks and weeks to get it where I need it to be. And I think other people are a lot more effective than I am, so.
No, I think it's an interesting process. I mean, that's the artistry. People talk about the art of winemaking and blending. You just described it. It's not exactly an easy process. I mean, I don't know of very many artists that just have a smile on their face the entire time. So this is the work part, and the fact that you actually know and can define that moment in time and wine, actually, more accurately, when things do come together and it aligns with your vision that you had in your mind, that has to be really special.
Yeah. No, it's a great moment when you know you've got it, and you can walk away, get in the bottle, let it age, and introduce it to your clients and friends and fans. And that's my favorite part of the wine business, is being in the vineyard and then opening the bottle and sharing it with people. I call it the bookends of the wine business. To me, it's the most fun and it's the most important.
And that's where the other phase starts. This is a pleasurable part, sharing the wine. But how do you scale it? How do you actually get people to get to know you and be able to, you know, not just know the brand, but know the story?
Yeah.
How do you go about this?
Yeah, I think it's getting out there. A lot of what I'm doing now is you know, private events with wine dinners and things like that. So you get these fans, these influencers, and then they invite 20 of their closest friends. I find that 20 is the perfect number, or I don't say perfect, but right about the perfect number, because you have enough one-on-one time or intimacy to be able to tell your story and to connect people to them. Gives them time to give you ask questions, and then it creates that special experience. You know, as you really can't find my wines in your local wine retail shop or supermarket, it's, you know, I allocate twice a year, so it's nice for them to be able to get something that, you know, isn't widely available, that that they could potentially enjoy.
So you said you're 90% subscribed, which again is a big statement.
Mm-hmm.
You made a lot of friends. People really love the brand. How accessible are you? Can someone that's listening to this send you an email and say, you know, I have 20 friends that want to come and have dinner?
Yeah, I mean, I'm event driven, and certainly if there are people who would like to come up and visit, I certainly can accommodate, schedule permitting. I've just got done traveling for 3 weeks, but I'm largely around here the next couple of months doing things with, you know, I just bottled the 2018 Sauvignon Blanc. So there's a lot of ability to control my schedule.
Yeah.
I can't control the harvest or anything like that, or, you know, in the October timeframe, but up until then, you know, I'm very much client facing and happy as the owner winemaker to present the wines based on availability for sure.
That is really good news for you guys. I mean, to me, FaceTime with a vintner and winemaker, you cannot replace that with anything. It's so important as evidence. I mean, I saw you recently did a dinner with Ralph Hertelendi. So
yeah,
those conversations about how Napa is so not accessible and this and that, that's not true. It's very generous. It's very collaborative. There's so many friends and colleagues. Everybody that I've ever talked to is very generous, not just like you described with the consumer, but with each other. So it's just, it's one big communal place, and it's so much fun to come to the table, and you will gain not just from the wine degustation or partaking in a wine dinner, but also how fun is it to sit down with two people that are so different. Yeah. And exchange ideas and impressions, and it's so convivial. I mean, I can't think of anything better.
Yeah, I mean, I think really my experience with Napa Valley, it's a lot of co-opetition. So, you know, really, there's no downside to partnering with other wineries. In fact, I think it's a plus. It's a synergy. They have different styles of wines. They have a different story. And it makes it just better for the guests, right? They get to try more wines in one place and different wines. So, you know, I think it can only benefit. I think we're very fortunate as small wineries to be able to partner with larger wineries like Saint-Supery. We were with them in Hong Kong and Japan in January.
Very cool.
And other wineries, you know, it's very much a cooperative group. So. Mm-hmm. I like that. And winemaker, I think all over, you know, you talk to, you know, cellar workers, winemakers, proprietors, principals, everybody's, you know, very, very much willing to open their doors to you and vice versa. So I think there's a lot of synergies here and a lot of, you know, a lot of great stories that have been told, but a lot that have not. So, you know, it's nice to be able to get the word out.
So you have every incentive to come over and find out for yourself. I mean, I learn stories. I've been coming here for 2 decades every single time I come. And it never gets old, and it's always so stimulating and gratifying. And it just, you know, here you feel like you get a dosage of sanity away from the chaos and nonsense. This is hard work.
Yeah.
This is agrarian community, but my God, is it aware and enlightened and generous. So, I mean, I've been a lucky beneficiary, and I hope that you guys that are listening have heard enough incentive, and you haven't, I'm sorry, I cannot help you at this point to really, you know, learn for yourself. Don't take my word for it. So my next question is a bit personal. I want to get into your cellar a little bit and then into your wine drinking journey, so to speak. You've been exposed to so much, to, you know, both in Europe and here. And I know you've cited, I mean, wines always taste better contextually when you're sitting, you know, at some little cafe sipping wine at noon, you know, in Barcelona or elsewhere, you know, it's a different situation, you know, it affects you differently. But generally, has there been epiphanies, and, you know, what is it that you drink?
Yeah, I don't know if there's been any epiphanies. There sure have been a lot of, you know, interesting wines and interesting conversations, and, you know, I'm getting to like a lot more sparkling wine now for an introduction. I've really been a little bit closed off, but, you know, going to sometimes events, I get to sample other people's wines. So I have what's called a house palate because I only try my own wines, and I, you know, I say I don't get out much. So it's nice to be able to try other people's style of wines. You know, Albarinos, Picapol, which is just a nice start, just different style, different. It's nice to be able to taste the terroir behind the wines or the climates. Mm-hmm. So very high acidic and very limited amounts. Mm-hmm. But, you know, trying, I think, also just trying library wines. So I mentioned the trip to Hong Kong. I tasted more Napa Valley wine in Hong Kong than I ever have here because we were at a cellar. Well, there's a lot of clients that have big cellars that one person started bringing out their wines, and then it was like a competition to see who could bring out, you know, the oldest vintage or the most different. So I tried a 73 Heinz there, I believe.
How about that?
And yeah, so just trying library wines that, you know, over 10 years was really exciting to do.
Yeah,
I bet. And, you know, there's a bunch of other ones that that escape me right now, but this, like the 73 Heinz in Hong Kong as opposed to here. So that's always really nice to try those older wines to see how they've aged and developed. And because I get that question, like, what will your wines be like, or how long can I cellar this? And, you know, I really haven't tasted a broad array of those library wines that are, you know, 10 to 30 years old. And that's always nice.
So how was the 73? I know 74 was such an iconic vintage, but how did 73,
it was very light. You know, they're a little bit lower alcohol then, like 13.9, 14. And so it was very light, very elegant, very soft, but still had a lot of life left in it. So it was really, really nice. You could tell it's been aged, and tell it's been softened. Tell it was lower alcohol, but you can tell it was stored really well.
Yeah, and it's so gratifying to learn that, again, in the 70s, how many treasures were made that, you know, are not often brought up as a subject of discussion.
Yeah.
And honestly, what I appreciate so much about your wines is that you brought up the age-worthy factor. I think that every single wine of yours that I've ever tried could lay down very nicely. But it's not a requirement. You can drink them young.
Well, I release when I think it's ready to drink. Other people have mostly agreed. I haven't heard anything otherwise. But since I'm not a corporation, I just start tasting after, you know, 3 years.
Yeah.
And it's like a child growing up and developing. And it's amazing. Sometimes it turns a corner and it's just like, this is ready, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't always release my vintages in consecutive order. So I release my...
Wow, that's really unusual.
Yeah, I release my 2011 after my 2013.
Huh.
You know, 2011 was probably the most challenging vintage that I've been a part of, just because there's rains and then heat spikes during the harvest time. And, you know, we picked when we wanted to, but the vintage was just a little bit different. So it really benefited from that other, you know, that bottling cellar time.
2011, unfortunately, was a bit panned by the popular press, which I feel is quite unfortunate because people like you made tremendous wines. They were different.
Yeah.
You know, we had probably, that vintage was more similar to the old world in terms of weather conditions and various events that occurred at the least convenient time. But people like you that really have a foothold in the vineyard, you know, they have the answers because this is something that you just prepare for and not necessarily, you know, wind up with a disaster on your hands. You wind up with something that needs to be more carefully managed. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
I think so. I think it depends who you talk to. But, you know, some people, you know, maybe general consumers, there's a little bit of, you know, less of a favor of the wine. If you talk to sommeliers, they love it all day long.
Yeah.
They love it all day long because they know how to pair it. They like that style of wine. It's a little bit more old world. And, you know, I think every winery has the right to release it when they think it's ready. It's not just consecutive. Unless you're run by a financial entity, you should be able to release that wine when it's ready. You know, maybe it does have an economic impact, but if you put the quality first, I think, you know, you could really have something special.
And again, that's so important when you talk about quality. It's not just what's in a bottle. It's also that moment in time. And the wine is cellared, you know, at the source. It's not the most economically advantageous thing, as you pointed out. Mm. The accountant's not happy, but the fact that you feel that strongly, that you want to present to the consumer the best expression as you see fit, and you've nurtured that wine from inception, so you really are the best judge of that. That says something about honoring consumers' time and money.
Yeah, and it's fun to be able to see it evolve in the bottle. So starting to taste it after 3 years, and then once every month or two, and see how it starts to evolve, and you can kind of get an idea of where it's going. And then once it's ready, it's a beautiful thing because it's waited all that time to be able to be put in the world. So it's a great moment. And yeah, every vintage is different, and You know, we like to respect the vintages, and it's great to compare them and tell the story.
You know, we've talked a lot about just showing up from the consumer's point of view. Mm. I'm wondering if we left anything out because, again, as a consumer myself, first and foremost, it's an overwhelming world, you know, to look at any given shelf at any given bottle shop and see all this examples of craftsmanship.
What's out there, yeah.
So it can be confusing and intimidating, and you know, you get all this kind of conflicting advice sometimes, depending who you talk to.
Yeah.
Have you come up with any ideas or perhaps solutions or advice for an average consumer that wants to drink well? What would you recommend?
I mean, I don't think there's any easy answer from a mass, like a supermarket standpoint. Mm-hmm. I would say go to a local wine shop where you have people that really know the wines.
Back to the consumer participation. You were mentioning that once you're in a shop and you're looking at all those choices.
Yeah, I think it's your local neighborhood wine shop. People are really knowledgeable. People who go to trade events. People who actually meet with the wineries or the representatives to really taste the wine and hear the story. And obviously those people come to their shop, but I think they're the best people to kind of curate what you're looking for. And then if you buy from them before, they know what you may like. The few you know, restaurant or retail that I've presented to, they go, I know a couple clients that would like this. So
yeah,
you know, I'd like to acquire. So I think once they know your palate and they've tried a few things out, I think that's the best way. I think, you know, if you want to use an app and things like that, it's a little less personal and it may guide you in the right direction, but it might be a more of a trial and error type of thing.
Yeah.
But I think your local wine shop and could do a really good job.
Well, I'm a bit biased. I think there's nothing, again, like going to the source.
Yeah, I think that's, you get a lot of course, value that's the best way, yeah.
Yeah, and no matter how knowledgeable somebody is, which, you know, by the way, I understand that it's not accessible to everybody to hop on a plane and get to Napa. It just happens to be my first choice, okay? Mm. But barring that, I think you're absolutely right. Is finding somebody who aligns, you know, with you as far as not necessarily even the taste, but the mindset that actually bothers to get to know you and what you're looking for. And then it's trial and error. I mean, not everything they recommend is going to happen for you.
Yeah.
But at least you made an effort and try to figure out what is it that you might like in the end.
Yeah, I think that's where the your local wine merchant can calibrate based on the feedback from what you bought last time or what somebody bought last time.
Absolutely.
And then they can really dial it in.
No, it makes perfect sense. And last but not least, you've now been in the Valley, well, you've been here since inception, but professionally speaking, you know, for again a number of decades and observed Valley just growing up, but also, you know, how much it's changed. Even in the last decade, I feel like my head's spinning.
Mm-hmm.
What is your assessment of it, and what are your thoughts about moving into the future? Do you feel that, you know, there are things that are concerning you, there are things that excite you, energize you?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're witnessing some urbanization in Napa.
Yeah.
So you're getting that kind of a urban feel, urban tasting rooms, things like that. I think it's great for the people who visit there.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a nice evolution. Even wineries at Up Valley here are having tasting rooms down there. I think that's great. I think where the, you know, you take a couple steps further is where you get kind of people really want to discover things, and there's certainly benefits to being in Napa, but I think it's, you know, discovery. So I think, you know, getting people past you know, Napa and Yountville is a great thing. And you know, a lot of people that I meet, they say this is our Disneyland, right? This is we come here and we, you know, this is what we do for fun. And so they are really the enthusiasts that really like to look under the covers and find hidden gems and discover new wines and things like that. So, you know, I would encourage anybody that is going to visit Napa Valley or considering it to consider coming, you know, up Valley and discover the little wineries and places they may not have heard of.
Off the beaten path.
And I think, well, I mean, I think growth is everybody everywhere. I think, you know, because of the preserve and just the amount of acreage that you know, there's not going to be too much more urban development outside of the city limits, and I think that's good. I would just like to see a little bit more accessible living for those people who support the industry, like sure. farm workers and things like that. And a lot of times they're traveling from way outside this area to come here. And we have the highest labor costs for farming in the United States. And if they still can't live here, that's going to present a challenge, because they're the backbone of the valley and they keep it running. So I think that's one of the challenges that Napa will continue to face.
Yeah, so in the serious note, this is a stunning valley and such a beautiful community, and the spirit of generosity, like we talked about, permeates the qualities there. But at the end of the day, let's keep in mind, it's an agricultural community. It mm-hmm. depends on that. That's how most make a living. So, please come and kind of judge for yourself. And, this conversations about how expensive or inaccessible it is really, there's not much purpose to those. The truth is that there is a lot of cost that goes into production and labor and such like that. And how can you participate? Buy a bottle of Napa Valley wine. That's really the most direct way that I can put it. And what you're supporting is not just having a nice and, pricey bottle. What you're supporting really is a lot more than that. You're supporting a farmer. You're supporting the agriculture that we all love so much and that sustains us in many ways, not just in the consumptive sense, but I don't know about you, but there's a lot of social and spiritual value to me that is hidden in a bottle of wine that's well made. Thank you very much, Steve, for spending time with me today. I've learned a lot. I'm very excited to continue to try your wines because it's been such a rewarding experience. And I hope you guys look up Sartanella Cellars. There'll be a link for you to log on to the website and find out more.
Thank you.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.